You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, rags to riches, the self-made man. They're common phrases in American history. They're usually used in a positive way, virtues that help us find success. But our next guest says too much self-reliance has its downsides and that these ideas are at a toxic level in American society. In her new book, she makes the case that they limit our economy, our politics, our day-to-day lives. She calls for a more helpful future where we can be comfortable depending more on one another and, in some cases, the government. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the principle of self-reliance has gone too far, or do you like that this is a big part of the American ideal? If you have lived in the U.S. and elsewhere, how do you compare and contrast our ideas of self-reliance in the United States versus other places you might have lived? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Alyssa Quart is a journalist, poet, and author of books including Squeezed and Republic of Outsiders. She's executive director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. She collaborated with WPR's To the Best of Our Knowledge on a three-part series called Going for Broke. Her latest book is called Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. She'll be at the Wisconsin Book Festival in Madison on April 11th. Alyssa, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, it's great to be here.
You've written a lot in the past about money, work, and how tough it can be to afford life in the U.S. for a variety of reasons. What led you now to tackle the idea of self-reliance?
Well, I've been running this organization, the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, which I created with the late, great Barbara Ehrenreich, for 10 years, which means I've gotten 10 years worth of letters and comments from people saying, you know, why are the people that you write about and the people who write for us, because some of our writers are working poor, why are they struggling so much? Why don't they own their house? Why do they own their house? Why don't they have a college education? Why do they have a college education? Kind of fault finding people for their own economic instability and poverty. You know, why do they have kids out of wedlock or, you know, without a husband? You know, why do they have kids with different men? You know, and there's a lot of blame and kind of moral finger pointing that I saw. And I wanted to know where that all came from.
You dug into this history. And one of the things you found is this idea of pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps that made it into the title of your book was actually originally kind of an absurd statement, a mocking statement. Some of the first examples, interestingly, in newspapers here in Wisconsin. Can you talk about the origin of that phrase?
Yeah, there was a farmer named Nimrod Murphy who newspaper article was mocking him for that he wasn't going to be able to get over the Cumberland River or a barnyard fence, and they used the straps of his boot as a joke. And then later in the Racine Advocate, they said, you know, the governor must be trying to pull himself up by his bootstraps. And again, it was mocking somebody like, what a joke. Like you can't chew gum and walk at the same time or whatever. It was that kind of phrase. But over the decades, it became this reality. People were like, okay, I got to really do this. You know, people are taught in school now that they're supposed to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. Somebody came up to me at an event and told me that he'd been taught that in school. So we've come a long way since it was a joke in Racine.
Then there's the frontier idea where, you know, people went out and homesteaded and settled and lived tough lives, which they did. The tough life part is pretty true, I think. But as you point out, they did it in one of the largest federal government giveaway programs ever. Could you talk about that that paradox of our frontier myth-making?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, what inspired this was I was reading Laura Ingalls Wilder, Little House on the Prairie and, you know, Plum Creek and all these other, which of course, you know, she was actually born in rural Wisconsin. So it's perfect. I'm talking to you about this in 1867. But her books were all extolling, you know, her ma and pa, we remember them, you know, Michael Landon in the 1980s TV show, 70s and 80s, doing it all by themselves, you know, planting their crops. As it turned out, when you look into this, first of all, Pa was a terrible farmer and he needed the help of his neighbors to, you know, feed his family. But second of all, they got money from the federal government through the Homestead Act of 1862. So this family got a parcel of land for free, and it was one of the biggest land giveaways in our country's history. And one of the pioneer mythologies, right, is I did it. We did it on our own. We arrived by this in this covered wagon. We chopped our own wood. We built our own house. That sure, that's true. But they also got the land for free. This is not happening now.
I'm going to skip over a bunch of history and look at the present day and the stories we tell about ourselves. And you say whether we're talking about politicians or a lot of people who might look self-made on the face of it, parts of the story, parts of the biography get left out. Could you talk about our, I guess, modern day myth making?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's somebody right now who's about to be indicted, Donald Trump, who would constantly say he was a self-made man and that his father was a Horatio Alger story. But it obviously, I mean, he was raised with millions of dollars. He'd been given a $1 million loan, right, to start a business. And, you know, he was in a huge amount of debt also, and he kept borrowing money. So he was dependent on his creditors as well. And obviously, every single person who worked for the Trump organization, and at this point, these, you know, millions of voters who follow him, and Elon Musk similarly is sort of extols doing things by himself. You know, now he owns our big social media platform, Twitter. But you know, he also got money for his research and development from the federal government, and he also came from wealth. And so I just felt it was important to keep saying, not that there's something shameful about coming from wealth, but these people were born on second or third base. And so this assumption that we're all supposed to be able to be a tycoon or a titan or run for president or, you know, just survive easily is a lie.
Talking to Alyssa Court about her new book, Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. You can join in with your thoughts, experiences, or questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Paul is with us in Northern Illinois. Paul, hi.
Hey, how you doing, Rob? Good to hear you.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about, Paul?
So, in my early 20s, I was a floundering, panicky, angsty young man trying to sell stereos and TVs in a store and just trying to make my way. And, you know, in our system, afraid of sort of just poverty, I guess. And I moved to Denmark, and I lived there for 16 years, and in my time there, the first thing they did when I landed was gave me a national health card, so I had free health care, and then I received a stipend until I got on my feet, which took me about a good 6 months to start being self-sufficient, and they would even supplement via aid if I needed it. My kid right now is going to college. It's paid for. Taxes are enormously high there, in our view. So if you're rich in America and you look at their tax base, you would say, this is crazy. However, when you think about how it's distributed, they don't have the angsty, panicky young people like I was. I'm extremely grateful for a social democracy, not a socialism, but social democracy.
Paul, thanks for sharing your experience. Alyssa, what do you think of his compare and contrast story there?
I love that. I mean, one thing that I found, I looked at volunteerism, you know, where people lend a helping hand, right? That's something that is always being extolled in this country and is supposed to replace the kind of social safety net the caller just mentioned. But in countries with the highest volunteerism rates, Denmark, as he said, Netherlands, Canada, New Zealand, they also have the strongest government-supported safety net. It's not a zero-sum game. You'll still be helping your fellow man, and you'll still be, you know, creating mutual care systems in your social environment if you had a better social safety net. And also, I mean, if you look at the OECD numbers of industrialized nations, the U.S. has gives the least part of their GDP to daycare, at least one of the least, to daycare or childcare for their citizens. And that's just another thing that there's no real reason why. And there's this idea that somehow people won't be taking care of themselves or being good citizens if they don't have a social safety net.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to David now in New Richmond. David, hi.
Hi. Say, I would 100% agree there's nothing wrong with the social safety net, but I would have to disagree kind of with the premise here. You know, my grandparents came from Germany and had nothing, and my grandfather apprenticed at the railroad and worked his butt off, became a shop manager, and my father apprenticed, became an expert in the rail industry, working at railroads, which were union-based. But here's something that my grandmother said when my father ended up going with another railroad that went bankrupt, and he went out on his own as a businessman, and I was complaining that he was gone a lot, and this is what my grandmother said to me. There are people who let things happen, and there are people who make things happen. Which one are you going to be? Whether it's a job that you're trying to get better at or the business that he's trying to make, you have to make a decision in your life. What kind of person are you? Are you going to let things happen, or are you going to make things happen? That stuck with me the rest of my life.
David, thanks for the call. Alyssa, your thoughts?
Well, you know, it takes 10,000 hours to have mastery over a domain. It was one of the studies someone had done, and it's been proven over and over again that kind of hard work and effort and exertion is really how we become good at something. So the caller's right. It does take hard work, but it's not hard work alone. And that's just the point of this book, that it's gone into overdrive. I mean, yes, my grandparents were immigrants. They came from Poland, Hungary, Russia, and they didn't speak English when they arrived, and they became American citizens and, you know, sent me to college and money working in a shoe store. So I'm with the caller. I understand they work 6 hours, 6 days a week. But at the same time, right now, it's this kind of rise and grind mindset. Like if you go on TikTok or social media, you'll see you can they say things like 9 to 5 is for the week, or you know, you have to have lots of side hustles. And it's a really frightening version of this hard work ideology that we live with, you know, that is not, it's not really supportable, because one of the things of the messaging is that you have to do lots of different things, which is not what your grandparents did or what my grandparents did, because that kind of dissipates your energy. But they're saying you got to, you know, be a work as a physical therapist and a personal trainer, and then you have to sell CBD, and then part of a multi-level marketing scheme. It's the variety and the number of things that gigs that we're supposed to be working, and the lack of unionization for the work that we do have.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to journalist and author Alyssa Court about her latest book. It's called Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about self-reliance, how we talk about it, think about it, practice it here in the United States? Do you have ways in your family, your neighborhood, your group of friends where you depend on each other, rely on each other? Do you feel bad when you have to reach out for help, whether it's to a friend or family member or to a government program? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to journalist and author Alyssa Court about her new book, Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Alyssa, before we go back to our callers, I want to talk sort of about the emotional side of our attitudes toward help. I'll share a very, story from my own household. I've been married a long time. When I'm sick, my wife takes care of me. When she's sick, I take care of her. Invariably, the sick one getting taken care of apologizes again and again. Sorry, I'm such a pain. I'm such a bother, blah, blah, blah. And the other one's like, shut up. That's what we're here for. Why do we feel so ashamed, maybe, or apologetic in those moments where we might need help, even though we know we're going to offer it the next time around?
That's so funny, because I think this is what the difference between the Midwest and like a strong elbow New or sharp elbow New Yorkers. Because when I'm sick, I'm like, get me the orange juice. There's no apology. What I'm trying to develop in myself, and I want others to find in themselves, I call it the art of dependence, not just interdependence, dependence. And it's really hard to learn how to either take care of someone else or be taken care of without apologizing, and to see it as an art and a craft and a skill, like something that we should be proud of. Like, usually we're ashamed of any dependence that we have, and independence is what we value. When kids, you know, climb on the monkey bars, we say, good, you're doing it by yourself. But, you know, the parts of children that are dependent and the parts of adults that are dependent, are of value too. And so that's part of what I'm trying to do in this book. It's also a, I call it radical self-help. It's like to have more acceptance for ourselves when we are at our most vulnerable and needy, so we can also accept others when they're vulnerable and needy.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Heather is with us in Brookfield. Heather, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Heather?
Yeah, this is a really interesting topic because it brings me to a specific time in my life when I had just had twins. And it was interesting. I was in another state, and their state, my husband was a student and going through a master's program and working. And so we were on Medicaid, but under Medicaid, they did not even let me see an OB-GYN. They just had me see family medicine residents. The whole time I was pregnant with twins, and I didn't even see an actual OB-GYN until I had complications after the operation. And I remember standing in my apartment, and I had complications. I didn't understand them. I couldn't do the things that I used to be able to do. And my parents were there to help me, who came from a rugged line of pioneers. And my dad went to Harvard. You know, they were hard workers and instilled that hardworking aspect in me, which I lived my whole life. But up until that point, I suddenly couldn't do the things I used to be able to do. And my dad said, Heather, you need to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And I knew that I couldn't. Like, that was not possible.
Heather, thanks a lot for sharing that story. Alyssa, we can be self-reliant until sometimes we can't.
Yeah, I just found that very moving, Heather, because that was part of when I recognized dependence, or both my daughter's dependence on me and my dependence on others. When I was pregnant, I was at hyperemesis the whole time. I don't know if anyone has had that, but you're sick the whole time. It's what Kate Middleton had. And you become very dependent on people, something you're not used to when you're, you know, youngish. I was in my 30s, a woman. So the Medicaid story is heartbreaking that you didn't get adequate care. But I also think I'm glad that you had a voice inside yourself that said, I can't do this alone. I need more than this. And that's part of it. I mean, we can try to find the resources, try to develop them both politically, economically, and in our neighborhoods, you know, within doing it ourselves. But we also have to have that voice inside ourselves saying it's okay to need it. So thank you for sharing that.
Heather, thanks a lot for calling in, talking to Alyssa Court about her new book, Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. Alyssa, you conclude your book offering some advice. There's going to be a lot of policy debates about what state and federal government might do, but you also offer suggestions about how people can build communities where people help each other. Can you share some of the practical advice you give in the book?
Yeah, so I went on a journey, really. It was during the pandemic, and I went on a journey to find alternative American dreams. And I did find them. I found them in the ways that people were organizing businesses, something called worker co-ops, where the workers own their own labor. They own their companies or the nonprofits that they work for. And I interviewed many people who belong to those. I talked to people who were part of mutual aids. I'm sure in Madison and other parts of Wisconsin, you guys had that, but during the pandemic, where people delivered food to their ailing neighbors, and it was reciprocal. It's not a charity. You may give food one day or pharmaceuticals one day, and the next day you receive it. Other forms like participatory budgeting, where citizens help decide city budgets and they sit in on meetings. Again, it's a voluntary thing. And also kind of therapy that was interesting, because right now we have a epidemic of anxiety and depression. And this was kind of mutual care therapy that was peer-to-peer therapy, where people would talk about their economic struggles, sort of like what Heather just did, as part of the therapy. And I found that very beautiful. I came up with a name for it, inequality therapy. But these are just a few of the fixes that I found, new American dreams that I found.
Do you have thoughts for us to do kind of, I don't know, maybe a self-reliance gut check and inventory to see, hey, yeah, these are ways I can be totally self-reliant, and that's cool. These are ways where maybe I should let some help into my life.
Yeah, that's sort of what I've been trying to do. And when I've been talking to people about this, and I mean, one thing that I've done is to try to find the sources of my own strength or happiness or achievement, think about who was behind them and sort of attribute. That's become my mantra. Rather than gratitude, I think about attribution. So, you know, the people I work with at the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, my mom, my grandparents, you know, my daughter. Yeah, just all the people like you, the people that I worked with in Wisconsin, you know, that really shaped me, changed my life, teachers I've had. And that's just, it's been nice to think about creative output or work output as a collective thing rather than just done by oneself. It makes it more meaningful, really.
Alyssa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Alyssa Court, journalist and executive director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. She's going to be at the Wisconsin Book Festival in Madison. That's coming up on April 11th, talking with WPR's own Shannon Henry Kleiber. You can also hear the work she did with, to the best of our knowledge, on the three-part series Going for Broke. We've got a link up at WPR.org/Central Time. Plus, if you need information about changes in Badger Care Plus, we've got a couple links up there alongside that one. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the President and Congress are working on budget plans for the country. We'll hear from a watchdog group about their concerns over the annual deficit and the growing national debt. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. This one's close to my heart and my upbringing. We're going to tackle Polish cooking with Wisconsin's Prince of Pierogi. Now, my grandma made pierogies. I tried to make it once, mostly by guessing without a recipe. It's one of the few completely inedible food products that I've ever tried to make. So I'm looking forward to that conversation. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Badger Care Plus recipients will be re-evaluated for eligibility and asked to reapply to the healthcare program for the first time since March of 2020. We'll get the details and find out who is affected. First, millions of Americans donate or sell their blood plasma, often as a way to make a little extra money on the side. What started as a relatively small industry a few decades ago has grown into a $24 billion global operation with over 1,000 plasma centers across the country, at least a few dozen of them here in Wisconsin by a quick count on Google Maps. The U.S. is one of only 5 countries in the world that allows people to be paid for their blood plasma. In her new book, our next guest shares her own experience on the receiving end of that plasma, and she looks at the problems she sees in the industry, from a disastrous story in China to what she says is a system of exploitation here in the U.S. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you donated plasma for money? What was that experience like? How did it fit into your financial situation? Do you work in one of these many centers around the state? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kathleen McLaughlin is a journalist and author of the new book, Blood Money, The Story of Life, Death, and Profit Inside America's Blood Industry. Kathleen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob, it's nice to be here. Thank you very much.
You're a journalist, Kathleen, so you're interested in this story, but you have a very personal interest as well. Can you talk a little bit about your own experience with what comes out of this industry?
Yeah, of course. It's been an interesting little journey for me because, like you said, I'm a journalist. I've been a journalist for more than 2 decades, so I'm just used to reporting and telling other people's story, but this one is very personal for me. So about 20 years ago, I was diagnosed with a rare autoimmune disease, and the treatment for that illness is periodic infusions of a drug that is made from other people's blood plasma. And over the years, I have spent a lot of time sitting in an infusion chair, to be honest, being really bored. So these drips take about 6 hours and they're quite dull. It's quite dull to be stuck in a chair for 6 hours. And I knew that this drug was made from the plasma parts of many different people. And so I just had this kind of ongoing fascination with who are all these people. I've known people off and on over the years, acquaintances, relatives of friends who have sold plasma, But I've never known that many people. And I knew that there were a lot of people engaged in this practice. I really set out to try and figure out who these people are, why people do it, and how important this has become to people's personal economics. And it's been a really interesting undertaking trying to figure it all out.
We're going to spend most of our time, Kathleen, here in the United States, but I want to start with a kind of a worst case scenario for what was called a plasma economy. You were interested in this because you had reported in China and there were boom towns of plasma there. Can you tell us a little bit about the disaster?
Sure. So I lived in China as a foreign correspondent for 15 years. And I moved there in the early 2000s, which was about a decade after the catastrophe of the plasma economy. So what happened back in the 1990s, China was really trying to figure out all sorts of different endeavors to increase their economy. So every province would come up with different ways that people could make money, you know, that workers could get involved in the system, that profits would grow. It was really turning from a state-owned economy into a capitalist economy. And in one of the poorer provinces called Henan, which is central China, the big idea was what you said, the plasma economy. And that was structuring an entire medical industry around the blood of poor people. So the idea was that farmers in Henan province who had no money, really, I mean, they worked the land and didn't have much beyond that, could get paid for their plasma, and the plasma would get made into life-saving medications like the one that I take, and it could be exported around the world, which seems, you know, like kind of a bizarre idea, but this is what they did. Unfortunately, this was during the period that HIV and AIDS were still quite dangerous and deadly, and HIV got into the domestic plasma extraction system in China, and it was spread through plasma centers and the use of unclean systems. So they were reusing needles, reusing tubing, things like that. And it spread the virus like wildfire. There were tens of thousands of people infected with HIV through plasma donation in the plasma economy in China in the 90s. There's never actually been a proper accounting by the government of how many people were made sick and how many people died. Instead, what happened is the Chinese government pretty thoroughly covered up the details of it and kind of tried to make it disappear from history. Two of the women who were the whistleblowers who uncovered this problem had actually fled to the United States and were living in exile here. And over the years, I got to know both of them pretty well. And one, whose name was Wang Xuping, specifically really encouraged me to look at what was happening in the United States with blood plasma. So I've been kind of explaining to people, I thought it was very dystopian and sci-fi that China had this idea for something called a plasma economy. But the fact is, we created it in the United States. It just hasn't gotten that much attention.
Talking to Kathleen McLaughlin about her new book, Blood Money, the story of life, death, and profit inside America's blood industry. Kathleen, one bit of good news, that that disaster in China, it seems like we're much healthier about the system there. The fear isn't so much spreading disease in this system. But that idea of a plasma economy built around poor people, that you see being replicated here in the United States.
That's right. So yeah, just to be clear, there's very little risk to donors in terms of contracting a virus, and especially not HIV. So plasma and blood science have evolved since this all happened in China. And we now know that treating plasma with heat and doing other things while the medication is being made pretty much eliminates the risk of viral transmission of things like HIV. So what happened in China is the odds of it happening here are slim to none. And that's just because medical science has gotten better. But what we have done is the same thing that China did, which is build an industry based on the body parts of poor people. So most of the rest of the world bans the practice of paying people for their blood plasma because it can be seen as coercive. So it's not a purely voluntary donation, if you're paying someone for it, there is an element of coercion to it. And ethicists and global health experts around the world have said, you know, this isn't the way that you want to base a system of blood or plasma donation, because there's this element of coercion. But we have let this happen in the United States, and we have really let it grow into a massive economy where there is this aspect of coercion. And people who need a little extra money to get by are doing this primarily for financial reasons. So I think there are a lot of ethical questions around it. There are also some health questions around it that I don't believe have been studied appropriately. So I do think that the potential impacts on a person's health long term do need to be better studied. But yeah, for me, the main question is, how do we become this society where people sell their blood to buy groceries? And are we really comfortable being that kind of society?
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jeremy is with us in Mineral Point. Jeremy, hi.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me. I just wanted to share, as a former college student, I lived in Southwest Wisconsin, and I was drawn to donating plasma out of a need to kind of supplement my income as a college student. And so, you know, I was a student who came from a low to no income background. And so I did not slow down and ask questions about plasma and where was it going and what would be the pathway to it helping or being some help to someone. It was mainly financial necessity to supplement for rising cost of college, as well as, you know, just kind of making up for where I fell short in comparison to some of my classmates.
And Jeremy, can I ask, how often did you donate? People do it maybe once. You can legally do it, I think, up to twice a week.
Yeah. No, I did it, I want to say maybe once or twice a month. But I will say I was inspired to do it quite more. There's a sort of predatory promotion in Southwest Wisconsin, particularly near the Dubuque, Iowa area. Like, you get incentives to go, you get coupons, you get all sorts of outreach and contact, especially when you enroll. And it's a thing that I see many of my peers get addicted to. But again, it's out of a necessity of shortcoming.
Jeremy, thanks for that call. Kathleen, Jeremy echoing so many of the stories you share in your book.
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy. I really appreciate it. You know, it is so interesting because college students really are a prime target for this industry. So you will see plasma centers kind of congregate in cities and towns that have big universities and big populations of students like Jeremy who need extra money to get through college. We have made the cost of education so expensive in this country, and we haven't done much to help people with it other than piling on mass amounts of student debt. So in my book, one of the places where I spent a lot of time is a city called Rexburg, Idaho, which has a large university with a lot of kids who are not wealthy. And this is one of the most popular ways for them to, you know, get extra money to buy groceries and books and pay rent and things like that. It's really, really common for college students to engage in this. And I've heard, you know, some people who are sort of dismissive about the concerns of what this does to people kind of write it off as saying, oh, it's just college students. But to me, I actually think that it's pretty important to think about what we're asking of a 19-year-old to sell a part of their body, if that's really something that we should be doing.
Jeremy, thanks for that call. Kathleen, Jeremy also mentions that pay incentive structure and the coupons. This is, he said it was in Southwestern Wisconsin. This is a very common part of the industry. Can you talk about how that works?
Yeah, totally. So the way the industry works and the way the system is designed is to get people to come back as often as possible. And so you'll get paid more for the second donation in a week. You'll get month-end bonuses. You'll get coupons. You'll get a bonus if you refer a friend to donate plasma. So the entire payment structure, even though it is framed as a token of appreciation for your time, not an actual payment per se. So they're very careful with the language because the industry does not want this to be regulated as an act of labor. So they're careful with the language, but it is entirely structured around incentives to keep you coming back and donating as often as possible. So if you go the maximum number of times, you can actually sell plasma 104 times a year, which is really an incredible amount. And there are people who are able to do this physically, and they get the most financial rewards from it.
We're talking to journalist Kathleen McLaughlin about her new book, Blood Money, the story of life, death, and profit inside America's blood industry. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how this works? Have you sold plasma yourself now or at some point in your life? How did that fit into your personal economy? Do you use one of these medications that comes out of this industry? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation about selling blood plasma with Kathleen McLaughlin. She's a journalist and the author of the new book, Blood Money, the story of life, death, and profit inside America's blood industry. You can join in maybe with your own experiences or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Before we go back to our callers, Kathleen, we heard from one of the demographics you write are targeted by the blood plasma industry for donations, college students. Also, working poor in often in Rust Belt communities, so-called, often here in the Midwest. Can you talk about that other target market?
Yeah, definitely. So I spent a lot of time in Flint, Michigan, which is representative of the demographic you just mentioned. So a lot of people in, I would say, what used to be good working class jobs in working class communities no longer earn quite enough money to have as good a life as they maybe would have 30 years ago. So a lot of the people I met are working in industries and professions full time that should be enough to get by, but they're not quite enough. And so they will sell plasma to supplement a full time job. I spent time with a local news reporter in Michigan who does this, and several other local news reporters as well. It's actually become pretty common for people to do this to not only buy necessities, but also to have a little bit of fun. So I've met people who sell plasma to save up to pay for a vacation that they might not otherwise be able to take. So it's these little kind of, I guess, the good parts of middle-class life that we used to be able to get by working one job, you know, where you could raise a family, that's just become so difficult in the United States now as incomes have not kept pace with the cost of living, and especially in this era of inflation that we're in right now. So it's very common. Plasma centers are very common in the Rust Belt, in the Midwest, in the South, in places where there is more economic hardship, and I would say larger populations. So you might have a small town somewhere that's poor, but you won't find a plasma center there. What the more popular place would be is a city with a larger population, but a larger percentage of that population who is living on the financial margins. So one of the things that surprised me going into this reporting, I really thought it was going to be only the poorest of the poor needed to do this. But it has become something attached to middle-class life and what we used to think of as middle-class income. So you have poor people, you have working poor doing it, but you have a lot of people who are on paper considered middle-class and okay, and they still need this to supplement the salaries that they're making.
Talking to Kathleen McLaughlin about her new book on the blood plasma industry. It's called Blood Money. Back to your calls now with Austin in La Crosse. Austin, hi. What did you want to bring up?
Hi there. Actually just driving by one of these facilities. I have a question regarding if we have concerns about the ethics of such a market as it's built right now. What does the alternative look like? And I guess I'm also just curious if the journalist here has any information about the difference between like blood banks and plasma centers. If I've donated plasma at a blood bank before, and if there's a difference between where my plasma would go from one place and the other.
Interesting questions, Austin. Thanks for the call, Kathleen.
Thanks, Austin. So first, to your first question, I don't think there is any chance this industry is going away. The United States has kind of quietly made a decision that we will allow people to be paid for plasma, and I don't think that's going anywhere. My kind of idea about this after doing all of this reporting is I think people should be paid more. I think the system should be transparent. I think Jeremy mentioned before this thing about, you know, incentives and coupons and things like that. Why don't we have a system that pays people a guaranteed amount every time? And beyond that, I think we are asking a lot by trying to get people to donate plasma twice a week. It's a huge commitment of time. It's a huge commitment of health. And your second question about blood banks, yes, you can donate plasma at places like the Red Cross. Those mainly go into, so there is purely altruistic nonprofit plasma donation, just like blood donation. Those donations of plasma would be more inclined to go into a hospital setting where the medication is made. The plasma industry tends to own the for-profit plasma industry tends to own its own collection centers. So for example, the medication I take is made by a company that owns hundreds of plasma centers across the US. So they own the product from beginning to end, if that makes sense. If you're donating at a place like the Red Cross, it's more apt to end up in the same place that blood would end up, which is nonprofit industry. So in a hospital setting or a medication that is made into those kinds of products. The other piece of that is more plasma is collected through the for-profit companies than through the nonprofit. So if you donate plasma at the Red Cross, you're limited to doing that to 13 times a year. If you donate plasma at a for-profit center, you can do it 104 times a year. So you can kind of just see from those rules that there's a lot more plasma coming in through the for-profit system than there is the nonprofit.
Thanks for that call. John joins us now in Appleton. John, hello.
Yes, hi. I used to donate plasma back in the 90s. I did it twice a week. And I often thought, I was underpaid for my time. Because as they say, you're not there selling a product or whatever. You're donating your time. And the thing that irritated me was a small person of 120 pounds would donate 660 milliliters of plasma, where me, I'm a big man, and I would donate 880 milliliters of plasma, and I was paid the same amount as that other person, which would take about 45 minutes for them and closer to an hour for me.
Interesting, John. Thanks for sharing that experience. He was maxing it out there, Kathleen.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, I think he's exactly right. It's just, if we're going to do this, and I don't see a way that you can roll it back, you can't, you know, there's millions of people who sell plasma every year. You can't ban it overnight. If we're going to do this, I do think we just need to be more transparent and fair about what we pay people. I mean, a lot of the people I've interviewed have told me, it only takes, the actual donation process only takes 45 minutes to an hour, but it eats up a half a day where they can't work. And a lot of people get tired afterwards. And so they need to go home and go to sleep. You know, there's a lot involved in this. And so to expect people to do it twice a week for a fuzzy payment system is not fair, I don't think.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Kathleen, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
That's Kathleen McLaughlin, journalist and author of the new book, Blood Money, The Story of Life, Death, and Profit Inside America's Blood Industry. Thanks for your great call. So many people we didn't have time to get to, but you can share your story if you'd like over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We have a conversation set up over there. Coming up after the news, for the first time since March of 2020, BadgerCare Plus recipients will be required to be reevaluated for coverage and re-enroll in the program. We'll explain the changes, get enrollees ready, look at the timeline. You don't need to panic, our guest says, but you should pay attention to what's going on. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.